We have an interesting panel with some of the best experts on photovoltaic in the country. I don't think I need to introduce my colleague Clark McFadden. He's an outstanding member of our steering committee, responsible for this work and willing to put in many pro bono hours to help us understand how we can advance this industry here in the United States. We're very grateful to have this panel with us. We will run a little bit of time over into the roundtable, but we're looking forward to an open discussion in that time frame. So, Clark?
Thank you, Chuck. It's a good opportunity to address a subject which even today has generated some controversy. It seems an idea that's fairly straightforward and simple, but it's actually, in my experience, very commonly misunderstood. What is involved in road mapping? What is its function? What makes it successful? When is it an exercise that people find controversial and difficult and rebel against? And in practice, it tends to have all of those reactions. And so it's important to try to understand its potential in the photovoltaic space and what it might do and what it should not be expected to do. Fortunately, we have some very knowledgeable, experienced folks to take us through these subjects. And I think we start with Ken Zweibel, who I think is known to most of you, a professor at George Washington University.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be involved with this process. I think it's very valuable to bring in the expertise that you brought in today to look at this question. So I took a look at what it might be to build a solar PV roadmap, and clearly the purposes have been stated already to accelerate PV progress to meet critical national needs and to do so in a cost-effective manner and to reduce the risk of deployment. If we're going to be deploying terawatts of renewable energy, including terawatts of solar energy, we want to do that as robustly and cost-effectively as possible. Right now, within the government, there's both technology push and market pull. This will be talking about a roadmap about technology push. Of course, one might expect that at some point you'd also have a roadmap that includes the market pull as these things come together into something that would lead to, again, that robust deployment. This is a kind of a summary, at least from my somewhat limited viewpoint, of what today's R&D is like in government. The NSF, the DOE Basic Energy Science, the new ARPA-E program, and the Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy Program. And what I'd like to highlight here is that the new programs seem to be all about the future, and I've to some degree been a little bit negative by using the term futuristic, in the sense that the probability of these futures are also in question. So there is a lot of enthusiasm at the government level for doing future work, and there is the DOE EER program, ERE program, which has historically been responsible for the technical work in PV that's led to this multi-billion dollar industry in the United States and world technology leadership and some of the technologies in that industry. And there seems to be a disconnect here, and I think this is a valid question. The question is, have we missed something? Are the people who are introducing these top-level programs missing something in terms of today's industry, or is today's industry, in the typical way that industry is, being parochial and thinking that it can answer all questions that can be addressed to it or answer them for the next 15 or 25 years? I'm going to come down on the second part, which is that they can. And I think that that's partially because we're in such a fast-moving field. To some degree, we're fighting the last war. We're answering the questions from 5 and 10 and 15 years ago in a world where things have really changed. where essentially goals that have kind of settled into people's minds, like a dollar a watt cost for modules, have already been achieved. But those goals and those ideas that today's technology is not cost-effective are still in the people's minds who are looking at this from the outside. And they're making choices about the focus of research on futuristic things when they could be enthusiastic about the out-of-the-box successes of existing technologies that have made the kind of progress that we're hoping futuristic things can make. I guess that's already summarizing what's said here, but I'd also say that that I do consider there to be a danger in some of this non-EERE work in that it's startup work, and that we haven't taken that fully into account. We're kind of in the belief phase where startup work is so wonderful and it's all going to work overnight, and that historically just hasn't been true. And that is a lesson you cannot ignore from 25, 30 years of work in this field, as well as all recent history, even, of technology startups that were funded at the 100, 500, and $1 billion level and still had tremendous difficulties. So we shouldn't be making this kind of mistake at this point of thinking that these startups are going to have immediate results. We should be doing a stair-stepped program where we have good faith in today's technology, good understanding of their potential, and we bring in the other technologies as they become mature enough. And I think we've had the same discussion about storage. Interestingly, the solar industry has looked at storage and said, we love storage, but we don't like its expense. We're awfully happy we can get to 10, 20, and 25, 30% deployment of solar like we can with wind without having bulk electricity storage. We might have distributed smaller electricity and power storage, but we won't need the bulk storage that, say, was talked about in the Solar Grand Plan in Scientific American in 2008. That isn't necessary for the short term. By the way, I wrote that, so... You know, so the good news is we don't have to worry about that kind of expense, but the flip side is we can time our development in that. We can develop it until we need it, and so we should do it in parallel. That's the way we need to think about these different photovoltaic technologies, these generations, or maybe there's some new word that makes them more interleaved than that, so that they are combined, but that we're thrilled that we have a good start. So I think the first solar roadmap that we need is the roadmap that helps the Congress, helps the new administration, helps everyone to understand that the opportunity that they're seeking in futuristic technologies is already at hand in existing technologies. Those technologies have proven cost reductions, have roadmaps individually to cost levels appropriate for cost-competitive electricity. And if we're going to be doing futuristic work, we should acknowledge it may take another 20 years and be planning in that fashion, not as if all these good ideas were somehow missed for the last 30 years, which, again, as I say, is kind of a symptom of this fast-moving field, that things have really progressed while people have been worried about it. So it's time to take another look. Maybe not only are those expectations impractical, they may not be necessary. So what I've said here is the Generation 1, silicon and thin films, today is going in at large systems at $4 a watt, a few years ago $6, and a few years before that $10 a watt. Those are phenomenal cost reductions. And a goal of $2 a watt at this point seems certain. I say that, it's like I want to bite my tongue, but enough people have said it that it really does seem like someone will get there for a big installed system. There are even advertisements by solar installers are putting in $3 watt systems right now over a megawatt in size. That's right now. People are putting themselves on the line, and I'm having a dialogue with people about that. And progress to $1.50 or even $1.25 a watt seems possible. And I want to say that 30 years ago, when we at NREL started developing these bottoms-up cost analyses, when we said that $1 a watt installed system was possible, we were regarded as stupid and naive. I want to tell you, we were just naive. Now, the fact that we might be getting close to a dollar a watt at this point just almost stops my heart. I mean, really does. I mean, it's just like, oh my God, can you imagine actually doing that? And that seems unreal, but it seems like it can be even stated again now after 30 years. So the generation two would be the concentrators, and those might shift into commercial status in the near term. And then the generation three, instead of thinking about them in the way perhaps people are thinking about them as somehow getting the cost effectiveness, we should be thinking about them as cutting costs in half again. We should think about 50 cents a watt installed systems. We should make it hard. You know, the use of new technologies can be integrated into the existing technologies. We can make use of nanotechnology as part of existing technologies. We already do with nanoparticle inks. We have for 15 years. We can do special nano absorbers in these materials to raise their efficiencies. But expecting that some kind of weird thing is going to come out of the blue and make everything different, well, that's naive again. Again, I guess I should excuse that, since people who are just starting have every reason to be naive. But perhaps we can understand that better now. I think the most important thing, though, is that we don't need these third-generation technologies to become cost-competitive. And so it's not a question that we should or shouldn't do them. We should do them, but we don't want to think we have to do them. So for me, a proposed top-level EERE roadmap, and I talk about EERE because to me they do the practical work in PV that pays off, is to have two kinds of categories: commercially proven technology with proven long-term potential to meet the cost goals, and another smaller category of post-proof of concept technologies that might meet the cost goals. And if you want to use a business criteria, you can say that the proof of concept have attracted some investment from private capital. The commercial is obviously commercial. If you've before both of these, then you're not on the EERE roadmap. And I think with so much being done outside EERE in these third-generation technologies, EERE should not be ashamed to drop them from their technology portfolio. I know that in front of the undersecretary, it's really nice to be able to talk about them to be well-rounded. But at this point, there's three programs doing them. The technical roadmap goals are always in cents per kilowatt hour, or they always have been. The reason modules sound like they, or people talk about cells, is that cells, which drive modules, which are efficiency, drive the cost of modules, and they drive the cost of systems. That's why modules are a high-profile goal. I call them a nickel a kilowatt-hour goals. I think below that, then you have your balance of system, penny a kilowatt-hour goals, with the inverter and the creative balance of system design, grid integration, sustainability, and ES&H, and other non-technical goals. And I want to also say that one of the key areas that I picked up recently, and I noticed it in the First Solar conversation, was the long time it takes to get to actually putting PV in the ground. Now, we know and we're proud of the fact that you can do PV installations in weeks or a couple of months, where other kinds of megawatt and multi-hundred megawatt systems require years. But that's turning out to be hard to do in the United States when you have to take a year and a half to permit that space. So there's a clear cost there. There's a clear number there associated with installed systems. If we're going to get to $2 a watt or $1.25 a watt, we're going to need that cleared out by some kind of a national process, a national procedure. So a roadmap might actually include doing that. That would be something probably people would agree to. Goals should be high-level and light-handed. Efficiency, cost per unit area, reliability. Allow creativity below the highest level. Don't be telling people how to do this. Ask for their best idea how to do it. And be aware of the breadth and the patience needed to make these goals. One of the things I'd like to see included in a roadmap process is continuous improvement and criticism. I'd really like to see meetings like this were basically about people throwing brick bats at the current roadmap. If you don't learn something from such a process, then you're dead. So I really think instead of defending ourselves against these inclusions of new ideas and inclusions of different viewpoints, we should enjoy them and incorporate them. And so the roadmap should not become onerous, because there'll always be an opportunity to change it. So this is an example of a roadmap as it's put together for one module technology. But bear in mind, this could be a balance of system. It could be those procedures for permitting. So you're trying to find the pinch points and the critical paths. And you identify those pinch points throughout the high-level goals. And these don't have to be that controversial. I think we can be pretty clear that many of these are things that can be a consensus within these technologies. Then you start to develop an RFP by understanding both the pinch points and the capabilities necessary to meet them. And you do the RFP as a virtual lab. We have talked about various ways to get together. You basically do this nationwide with universities, national labs like NREL and Sandia, and the companies. And NREL and Sandia obviously participate, because they must be working on the critical problems. Otherwise, what are they doing? So, of course, they participate. So, in conclusion, I would just like to say that I think the first and most important high-level roadmap is one that the Secretary of Energy and his assistants and the Obama administration, the Congress, and all the various congressional committees would be able to read and understand over the issue of, do we need a whole new set of technologies starting from scratch, or can we make incremental progress on the existing technologies we have now? I think that is the crucial question to get clear, because right now we are spending a lot of time and effort on things other than the existing technologies, even though the knowledge and the impact and the movement in this room is about existing technologies. The second roadmap is a high-level technical roadmap, which will always be continuously improved and just gives guidance to forming groups to respond to critical problems and pinch points. And part of my message is that this roadmap, or something like it, is needed to re-energize near and midterm government-funded research, because I think that many of us who do this kind of research think the government really just wants far-out ideas. And I really want you to know that that is the truth, that if you go around to 100 PV scientists who helped to make this industry, make it what it is today, their feeling is the government just wants far out ideas. Thanks.
Thank you, and thank you for this opportunity to give input in this important topic. Safe Harbor statement will be in the packet, because we're a public company, and there's some forward-looking statements here. This is a summary of the observations that I'd like to make. One really echoes what Ken just said, that PV is poised to become a significant source of cost-effective renewable energy. It doesn't need some far-out next generation to do that. Second is that a semi-like equipment technology roadmap is not appropriate for PV. This picks up that heated conversation that was mentioned earlier. And then I'd like to talk about how much good DOE has already done in this and the opportunities for continued contribution to drive us forward to help us in both the near term and long term. One of the things that was probably driving a connection between PV and semiconductor is that if you look in terms of dollar annual sales, PV right now is about where semiconductor was in the mid-80s, which is when a lot of the roadmaps were put in place to drive it further. But as I'll get into later, some of that, a lot of that analogy falls at that part. One of the things that it falls in is PV is already much more of a manufacturing intensive industry than IC is. Even over a year ago, the PV industry, this is just the crystalline silicon part, obviously, used more silicon than the entire IC industry. And it's grown a lot since then, with worldwide production last year of worldwide sales, production was actually even more, 6 to 7 gigawatts. There's been mention of this cost learning curve, and it has been remarkable. This is the one for crystalline silicon, going back to the 1979 at $33 a watt for a module, to recently where there was a spike up because demand got so large worldwide, the polysilicon industry wasn't able to keep up with that. That caused prices to rise. But the good thing about that is that it caused the industry to really be innovative and drive down costs in the balance of system portions. Now the poly is dropping back down, we're getting back on that learning curve, and in fact we're ahead of these fairly recent projections with costs, with prices below that. And at these prices, as Ken said, it's enough to drive levelized cost of energy lower than peaking plants and to then be competitive with even baseload plants. On the technology and equipment roadmaps, there is a lot that we can learn from the successes of the IC roadmaps, but here are my cautions and actual strong warnings against. And I think the medical axiom of first, do no harm, applies here. Because there are some very big differences between the PV industry and the IC industry. One was that the IC industry had a natural split of intellectual property between the processing and chip design. And there was a shared interest between those two groups of companies in geometry shrinks and other advances that were on a predictable schedule. And there's no analog to that in PV. Second is that most of the PV value chain isn't really related to the IC industry, that it's closer to things like construction, building materials, automotive, consumer electronics. Things that may benefit from a very high-level roadmap to communicate to the rest of the industry or Congress or other constituents what the costs are going to be and what volumes might be. But there are certainly not detailed technology roadmaps that deal with things like handoff protocols. The next is that some of the industry-derived standards would actually increase equipment costs because they came from an industry that had different criteria, much more steps, much less equipment cost sensitive. And in PV, that we cannot allow that to occur because in order for us to grow at the 40, 50, 60, 70% per year, you can't do that cash flow positive if you have too much CapEx per watt. Next warning is that it could undercut the existing collaborative infrastructure in PV. And there are some really good organizations out there encouraging that. Could also undercut guidance from organizations that are more familiar with PV. They could look to this new consortium as the provider of knowledge. And it could delay in the needed U.S. market development because we're waiting for this roadmap to be put in place for some future technology. And finally, it could pull resources and funding away from the needed diversity in PV. Even if it's voluntary, this would likely still occur. So that brings up, well, what would you do a roadmap for? Would it, even if you separated it by technology, you said, okay, we're going to start with a crystalline silicon roadmap. Would it be for the legacy architecture that where you can buy a turnkey line from Roth and Rao and make modifications to it? And that's an essential thing for the industry to be doing. SVTC is doing a valuable work in that area. But if the industry roadmap was built around that, is that going to pull resources away from architectures such as all back contact or HIT that would probably have more potential for lower levelized cost of system energy? How about the size? 5-inch, 6-inch, 8-inch? In the IC industry, there was a shared desire to go to larger because it reduced costs. But some of these architectures have lowest total system cost at 5-inch, and others will have it at 6 or 8 inches. How about polycrystalline or crystalline? N-type or P-type? Now, most of the industry now is P-type. And I was on a panel a couple weeks ago, And almost everybody on that panel talking about silicon was saying, wow, we're really seeing the advantages of N-type, and we've got to figure out a way to get there. If you really standardize on P-type, you're going to inhibit that. And even down to how you prepare the wafers, you know, you work on cleaved or advanced SAW. And the big warning is if you pull all the resources onto the legacy architecture, you pull them away from the innovations that are possible. How about if you had a separate one for SEGS? These are just some of the deposition methods for it. And it's not only that it's early in development, it's that there's different product characteristics that use these different ones, that you can have one that is best for one type of product and another that's best for another type of product. So the idea that we could just let it all sort out and there'll be one, or you could even encourage that standardization, would be counterproductive to the total system costs that are possible. And here are some, of course, the form factors that are available. Is it a cylinder for roof mounts, as one company does? Or is it some flexible that it's applied? Or large for a ground mount? Same type of thing for CAD Telluride. There's good companies working in all of these technologies. Amorphous silicon, different architectures there, both in deposition and the module. High concentration. There isn't a uniform way of doing that, and it's not only because we haven't found the one way, but because different applications will probably make use of one versus another. And then there's all the new technologies. Do you spend resources on some roadmap for that? Bottom line is, even if you had a separate detailed roadmap for each of these, it could pull resources in and discourage competition and innovation. This is a busy slide, so I'm just going to point out a couple things on it. All of what I just covered there was the diversity of the semiconductor-like part. This is the rest of the value chain. And for a traditional crystalline silicon, that semiconductor part, that IC processing that is so crucial in the IC industry, is 11% of the value chain. And a lot of the key innovation is occurring in other areas. And some of that innovation can't be decoupled from a roadmap that forces standardization. In system, you can have new tracking approaches that have a lot of advantages, but they may, you want a particular efficiency or module size or shape for that. In wafering, you could really focus on improving the current wire saw with diamond wire, for instance, or the new wafering that has a cleave process where there's no material loss between each wafer, and there's good activity going in both of those areas. Same is true across all of these areas. And the point is that that diversity is actually needed for maximum success of the industry. It's not just a byproduct of being early and not being a developed industry. The energy market is over $1 trillion a year. You're not going to have one product that addresses that market. The competition between these things drives cost reduction. The innovations in private funding for these different approaches are all have a chance of succeeding. And hopefully many of them will succeed, because multiple approaches, success of multiple approaches, gives a greater total volume than just one approach, because of the reduced impacts from a material limit in one, the ability to have more rapid scaling, because the constraints for each of those value chains are going to be different, and the diverse applications call for different product characteristics. Just as we don't have one type of consumer electronics, we won't have one type of photovoltaic module. The next three slides are just some of the diversity of systems just from SunPower. Now, granted, we're a big PV company. We're number one in the U.S. in residential, commercial, and one or two in power plants. But still, this is from one company using only one type of cell architecture. Here in residential, you can have building integrated for new homes. You could have the building applied. You could also have all the innovation around those systems, smart mount systems, monitoring, package systems, things that decrease the total cost of insulation or add value to the customer. In commercial, We have the original non-penetrating horizontal mount, but then new systems that give some of the same advantages. First, the one with the an assembled with tilt, and now most recently, which was developed under the DOE TPP that we participate in, a fully integrated solution where the module, the frame, the mounting are all in one part that just snaps together on the roof. And there are things such as this carport, which can add value to the customer even beyond the electricity. In power plants, there's a lot of innovation in some of the thin films, some movement towards module types that could mount quicker in fixed tilt. And with modules of at least medium and preferably high efficiency, tracking gets enabled. And the cost of tracking has come down by over a factor of two in the past few years. And it has advantages not only in LCOE, the levelized cost of the energy, but also in value to the customer. Undersecretary of State Johnson this morning mentioned a capacity factor of 20 if we're lucky. Well, a T0 in Las Vegas during summer, which is when the utilities want that energy, has a capacity factor of 39%. And the utilities are becoming educated about those effects, the time of day delivery of solar, which is much better matched to their demand than wind is. So, now switching to the recommendations instead of the negative. Downstream areas would have a big positive impact. Local markets with multi-year demand drive local manufacturing. That's where the majority of the jobs are in the value chain. And those steps are best done locally. It also builds up the downstream infrastructure, and we're certainly seeing that in places like Germany that are already better at installation than we are here. Those sales channels, personnel, all the other parts of that infrastructure not only has benefit for current technology, but has lasting benefits. If there is a third generation or fourth generation that comes to replace or complementary, that infrastructure is in place. There's other things that could be done, like long-term commitments for PV purchase, or even a carbon tax. And this is my little pet idea of refunding that to Americans on a per capita basis. So they look for that check, as much of a birthright as low gas prices. End project financing is a key constraint now. So some of the things that are ongoing now will have tremendous positive impact. And bringing down the other barriers for PV penetration will have tremendous value. Programs that directly encourage development and manufacturing are also needed and very useful. This is the areas that have been very successful for DOE, and continued work in this area is essential to move the many of these important technologies forward. If we're looking for something as far as ratings to do, module energy ratings is something that has value, and giving that volume cost roadmap upwards, very useful. Here are the key takeaways. PV is poised to be a large source of clean energy. IC industry doesn't really map to what we're doing, and there is a lot that DOE has been doing and can continue to do to move us forward both in the short term and the long term. Thank you.
I think if I could just start with a comment. I very much take your point that a roadmap that forces standardization should be resisted, and that diversity should be reflected in a roadmap. But it strikes me that many of your implied criticisms of the roadmap are not necessarily endemic in the roadmap itself. As I saw the semiconductor roadmap developing, what struck me as crucial to its success was that it reflected the input of literally all the knowledgeable players in that industry at that time, and that it wound up having a major impact because it was a realistic reflection of that particular landscape. And so it informed people who were focused in one or two particular areas about the opportunities, the obstacles, the gaps in technology generally. And then they were left on their own to figure out what's the most imaginative way to get around it, what else do we need to focus on, where is our effort and the broader industry effort best placed. Now, they had a lot of advantages of sort of Moore's Law, much more predictable kind of momentum, but the roadmap process itself seemed to me to be one that really was illuminating to virtually all the players in the industry. And so I just want to get your reaction to that.
I think those are great observations for the IC industry. I think that the process and the success there shows that it can be done for that industry. And it wasn't easy there. It's a testament to the intelligence and dedication of the people working on it. But if you look at the differences between the industry, I think that's where it falls apart. And you said that in the IC industry, it was driven by the people that wanted the results of that. Well, everyone that I've talked to in the PV industry has given the input, we don't want this type of roadmap.
Let me add a few words, and that is that I think maybe we're confusing two things together. I mean, there's certainly need and value in supporting technology development at companies and advancement in their manufacturing. There's certainly need and value in doing university research and foundational research to understand how these things work and building a science and technology base for these technologies. There's certainly value in bringing those two together and NREL together with industry as well as possible and protecting IP. I think it's also obvious that we don't walk around the woods with our eyes closed banging into trees. I mean, we do understand that the goals are cents per kilowatt hour, that lots of things contribute to that, and la, la, la. So I think the point is we want to develop those needs and those resources as well as possible, and we welcome the participation and the involvement and the commitment of the federal government and the various political constituencies who want to support that. And we will work with you to make sure that the money that you wish to help us to move forward with these various needs that we've made very clear could be well spent.
I agree with that 100%.
That's okay, Clark. I hear a lot of discussion today about the first PV roadmap. And in getting ready for this conference, I was doing a little research on the web, and I came up with PV roadmap 2002 that was industry-generated. It's listed on the Sandia website, and it's a 20-year roadmap. And it has short-term, near-term, and long-term objectives and goes through a lot of the issues that were discussed by a lot of the panelists today. So the question is, if it was industry generated, I'm curious to know if there's anybody in industry today that's in this room that helped participate in the development of that. Probably some of the leaders we have new leaders today in the industry that weren't present back then in 2002. And has anybody gone back to look at the 2002 roadmap to see where we hit it right, where we missed, where we can improve, and can that be used as a blueprint for improving to creating a next generation roadmap?
Can I make a comment on that? Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. I probably would have started saying the same thing. Ken suggested that we should not be afraid of throwing a few bricks, but I would throw a small pebble. That's about the roadmaps that was generated by the PV industry in 2002, and many of us participated in it vigorously. And then much later on, we discussed, and we again generated another roadmap where we said, what are the objectives, what are the goals? I think it is a success story. At that time, we said that the focus should be on cents per kilowatt hour, and we said that these are the triggers by which we can meet that cents per kilowatt hour. And you heard today when I gave the presentation in 2006, we thought if we can go to $4.50 per watt installed cost in 2010, we can declare a victory. Today, many people are offering systems at $4 a watt. So obviously, certain things that the industries did collectively, they're working. Why do you try to fix it when it is not broke? And the second point I would like to make is this fascination about doing something totally out of the box. I've been there. I've done innovation. I've done commercialization. And it is not trivial what we have done. It's not every day we meet challenges and do we do innovation. And suddenly thinking that I will do something totally new, which is going to fix everything, is utopia. These are my small pebbles.
Could I make a comment? Yeah. I think those are excellent points, and I completely agree. I need to clarify, my negative comments about roadmaps weren't a general statement. It's about a semiconductor-modeled roadmap, technology equipment roadmap. We participated in that 2002 industry roadmap, and it was a tremendous document that had a lot of benefit for the industry. And continuation on that type of thing and the ones that Ken had mentioned, I think would have a lot of value.
I wanted to make a similar comment, actually, so maybe it's a little bit redundant at this point, Doug, but having participated indirectly through my research advisor at the time in that and developing that roadmap, I think that there perhaps some of the resistance is, in my opinion, a sense that some of that roadmap then became a constraint rather than becoming a real benefit to the further development of the industry. It tended to channel development in some of the major conclusions of that. For example, that the largest obstacle to the development of the thin film industry was a consistent supply chain for large-scale thin film manufacturing equipment, never really entered into the funding plans effectively from that subsequently ensued through the Department of Energy's funding.
Well, certainly my sense of the semiconductor roadmap was it was not designed to pick winners. It was designed to provide a realistic view of the technology challenges.
So I want to say that what I learned when I listened to the roadmaps from the others was how to work together you know, what, how to deal with IP, how to get around, you know, intransigent organizational problems, you know, blah, 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 which we all need. But we don't necessarily need, you know, this exact roadmap, this kind of roadmap. You know, we don't need that necessarily model, but we need to learn, certainly. And the fact that we may have done 80% of that already in the past also is kind of nice. But the point is, we can do this. We can definitely do this. We know how to do it. We've done it, and we've had great results up till now, both from the industry and from the government programs. And yes, we welcome a renewed vigor in terms of the political support for solar energy. In fact, we know that there are some issues with that renewed vigor. We'd like to help you to gain that support.
Hi. My name is Elaine Ulrich. I'm with Congresswoman Gifford's office. So I don't know if this is so much a question for the panel as just some sort of food for thought for everyone who's here today. When we first came in this morning, I think the question that was in our mind, in the mind of the folks that work in our office and in Congress, is simply we're looking at where the solar industry is right now and where the PV industry is, and we're trying to understand what your needs are, and so we need guidelines. We need to have something to look to, something to turn to. And if you're saying to yourself, what kind of landscape are you all operating in right now? Is this a typical industry? Where's the money coming from? I mean, let's face it, a huge amount of money that's going to go into this industry is going to come from the government. What do you want to see guiding those investments? And in my mind, I would rather have the input from the actual members of industry. I'd rather see you all coming together, and you know, we'd like to have something that's documenting or telling us the status of things or the direction that you all want to go in. We need something to point to give us some kind of guidance and understanding. And you know, my question is, what kinds of discussions need to happen? What kinds of questions do we need to be asking in order to effectively support this industry? And for us, that's what we're looking for from a roadmap, is to know that there's some engagement from the industry that's helping to better inform us so that we can achieve what to me are huge gains. And so that for us was where we were coming from when we were thinking about what we'd like to see from a roadmap. So, you know, if you can all think about ways that you all can better communicate to us those kinds of things and perhaps participate better, that's what we'd like to see.
So we're going to let the audience, who from industry as well as SunPower, respond, since Charlie has something to say.
I think one of the comments I'll make here is that a way for us to respond to that great offer is to come back with what we're building on the renewable electricity standards. We need long-term continuity. We need the predictability that goes with that as part of government policy. So we've spent time and are continuing to work on how much photovoltaics can contribute to our clean energy base over time. At the beginning of the morning today, we had one of the PowerPoint charts had something about in 2020 or 2030 there's 6% solar or 3% solar. It can be 30% solar. If we come forward with that roadmap and we can work on quantifying the value of distributed generation along with what we can do with time of day opportunities as well, we can make, I think, a solid business case. With that solid business case and continuity of policy, banks will fund us. Right now, this all sort of stair steps from we need continuity of policy, which enables the banking community to have confidence that when we enter into a power purchase agreement, that's what it's going to be, and it's going to be that way for a certain period of time. Then that leads to the R&D and the manufacturing and the commercialization. And we've spent almost all of today talking about the technology roadmap, when what drives this industry is centered around the market and creating market pull. The story that Sebadu talked about in the morning. In 1990, there was a small pilot rooftop program in Germany, in Aachen, for rooftop photovoltaics. And Hermann Scherer took that and made it a countrywide goal in Germany to say we would have a feed-in tariff, and for 20 years, the electricity from those arrays would provide a cash flow, which was a better return on investment than most of the stocks or municipal bonds or other kinds of financial instruments available to people to place their investment money. Doing the similar kind of thing, what that did in Germany was it created the 100,000 jobs greater than the number of jobs in the auto sector. It created a manufacturing base. It created all of the R&D centers, the Fraunhofer ESA competing with the ISFH, with the University of Konstanz, and it created a steady stream of educated people. This is about jobs. And at the end of the day, the strength we have here is all about jobs, and those jobs require the universities. They require that pipeline of know-how. So I think it would best serve us to come back with that roadmap, starting with the market pull.
Could we use that as a transition into the round table, which is already going on? And simply change the faces a little bit up front, if John would come up. And could we have a round of applause for really stimulating?